We'll go ahead and call our first case. We've got T-Mobile versus City of Louisville. Mr. Thompson, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Scott Thompson on behalf of Appellant T-Mobile Northeast. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. Although there is a potential issue in this case of whether T-Mobile's initial complaint was filed early, the Court need not ultimately reach that issue at all because Rule 15C relation back cures any timing issue in this case.
Was your complaint an amended complaint or a supplemental complaint?
It was a supplemental complaint, Your Honor, under Rule 15D, and the District Court granted it under Rule 15D because it raised a fact that had occurred after the initial complaint.
Now, the Rule 15C relates, relation back doctrine of Rule 15C concerns amended complaints as opposed to supplemental complaints, correct?
No, that's incorrect, Your Honor. But courts have recognized, including the Third Circuit, that relation back applies both in Rule 15D, supplemental complaints, as well as amended complaints.
My question meant by its terms, Rule 15C refers to amended complaints.
On its face, it does apply to refer to amended complaints, but the courts, including this one, the Supreme Court, have all recognized that it applies as well to supplemental.
Isn't the problem with the relation back doctrine that if it relates back to the filing of the original complaint, then you're on this, as they said in the security insurance case, the legal merry-go-round, because now you're back to your complaint being premature.
That's exactly the trap that the District Court fell into here. However, Your Honor, as you point out, we have multiple courts, the Ninth Circuit in security insurance, the Eighth Circuit, even the Supreme Court in Matthews versus Diaz, where they cited to security insurance, have all recognized that the Rule 15C is part of the remedial scheme of the rules of civil procedure that are intended to be applied in a liberal fashion to allow cases to go forward on merits rather than technicalities. And so those cases have all held.
Is jurisdiction a technicality?
Your Honor, the cases have held that, in fact, Rule 15C does cure jurisdictional issues. However, in this case, this is not a jurisdictional issue.
Yeah, well, that's an important question, isn't it? You say it's not jurisdictional, but why don't you address the council tree language that talks about incurable prematurity?
Sure, Your Honor. So there are a couple of issues that I would point out. The first is that, as we pointed out in our reply brief, there are a series of recent Supreme Court cases, the Sebelius case versus Auburn Regional, the Machado case, that point out that in order for a timing deadline to be jurisdictional, there must be a clear statement from Congress making it jurisdictional. Okay. I would point out, Your Honor, that the Council Tree case.
Talk about Cal then. When we decided Cal, we said it looks to us like there's a jurisdictional problem here with the government's appeal or motion for reconsideration in that case. It doesn't save the government 15C relation back because this is language about jurisdiction that's embedded in the same section, the same piece of legislation or rule. And that's what I understand your opponents to be saying here. This is part of the same information or the same statutory subsection, that subsection B7. Mm-hmm. What's wrong with that reasoning?
Two things, Your Honor. Sebelius, Machado, the recent decisions by the Supreme Court made clear that mere inclusion of the timing issue within the same subsection that may grant jurisdiction does not make the timing issue jurisdictional necessary. And in this particular case, subsection 332, it's C7, capital B, little 5, is not written in jurisdictional terms. It says that a party that's aggrieved can bring an action within 30 days in any court of competent jurisdiction. That's very different than what I would point out in the, for example, the Council Tree case, That was an FCC case. The FCC's jurisdiction is addressed by the Hobbs Act, which specifically says, Your Honor, in 28 U.S.C. 2342, that jurisdiction is invoked. That's the kind of jurisdictional language that the Supreme Court's looking for.
Jurisdiction is invoked. Okay.
What are we to make of the assertion? You seem to have gone past your issue about a writing and assuming that it was premature. I mean, for purposes of our discussion, we've been talking in terms of this being premature, but you've made the argument that it's not premature. Are you moving past that because you don't really need it to win your case?
No.
Or because you recognize that it's pretty hard to say something's final when you don't have anything in this record, nothing to show finality except your say-so. There's nothing, there's no writing, is there? There's no transcript. There's no minutes. There's no...
No, Your Honor, there is.
Where is it in the appendix?
In the appendix, Your Honor, it is at A395 and 396. In fact, Your Honor, this is a situation where the city acted, took its vote. We asked them said, where's the written decision? We got no response. With the 30 days looking down the 30 days, we filed our complaint because we believe that was a final action. But after the city answered, it issued this written decision. And the parties went forward.
We're talking past each other.
Okay.
I know there's a later written decision, but your assertion is what happened at the meeting was final.
Yes, Your Honor, sorry.
There's nothing in writing to reflect that, is there?
No, Your Honor, there wasn't.
Okay.
That we know of.
So how would we write an opinion that would uphold your position that it was good enough for them to say it in an open meeting and trust us, even though there's nothing to reflect that in the record?
It is a conundrum, Your Honor, and quite honestly, we would prefer that there be a clarity. If the court...
But there was eventually a transcript made of the hearing.
There was a transcript, yes, Your Honor.
So why didn't you obtain that transcript before you filed your action?
I'm not sure when it was created, Your Honor.
Well, I think I looked at the court reporter certificate, and it was...
And perhaps I can...
January 10th. 1997, so after 30 days, but right. What would have prevented you from asking the court for whoever was there? There was a reporter obviously there to transcribe it. Then you'd have your right.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that a transcription done by a court reporter is not quite the same as unless it's adopted by the city. In other words, if the city had adopted that within a certain period of time, we would have then said, okay, then that maybe is the writing. But I don't think that occurred here. We asked the city, within 2 weeks after the oral decision, where is the written decision? Your Honor, this, I think, draws us to the issue that we've raised, which says that, following the analysis of the Supreme Court in the Roswell case, if the final action has to be a written decision, then there needs to be a corollary requirement that written decision follow in a reasonable period of time after the denial. The final act here being the vote, there's no question that that was its final action. Because otherwise, we have no...
No question it was their final action. If there was no question it was their final action, then we wouldn't be here, right?
Maybe.
Clearly, there's a question.
We shouldn't be because it was a technicality. There was no petition for reconsideration available. There was no further action we could take.
Is there, in Riverkeeper 3, mm-hmm. which we asked you to come
sure.
to discuss, we talked about looking at the traditional hallmarks of finality. Would you say that a written decision, a written statement, is a traditional hallmark of finality? Or do we traditionally operate on parties' assertions about what was said to them orally?
Two things, Your Honor. Number one, I'm aware of states where...
That's just a yes or no. You can explain afterwards. But do we traditionally operate on a party's oral state? Party's representation of what some government actor said to him orally, or do we traditionally, as a hallmark of finality, look for something in writing?
I would say that in most cases there's a writing, but it's not always. I would point out two things. I would say that, as I said, there are states where the state requirement runs from the time of an oral vote. I'm aware of, couldn't tell you one off the top of my head, but I've run into them, which is part of what raises this kind of, oh, God, we write it to file. But
when you say state, Riverkeeper 3 again. Do
sure.
we operate off what the state says is final, or do we
no.
operate on a principle of federal law?
Yes, Your Honor, you did adopt a principle of federal law, and I would point out that if you apply the principles in Riverkeeper 3 to this situation, the Zoning Board of Adjustments decision was, it marked the consummation of the agency's decision-making. It wasn't merely interlocutory. There was no, again, there was no option for petition for recon, which sometimes we see in, for example, the Council Tree case at the FCC. There was still a petition for recon pending.
There was no opportunity for you to say, we'd like something in writing?
We did. We asked them for it, and we didn't get a response. And that's at A71 of the appendix.
And
I'm sorry, A164.
Yeah. And is there something with the shot clock, so to speak, that you can prompt or provoke?
I think that that's a misleading sort of a red herring, Your Honor, to suggest that in a scheme where we have to file within 30 days, that a city could take an action, vote, there's no further procedure available, and that we have, the only option we have is to wait, and then file an action only for failure to act, the remedy of which would be now they're going to issue a decision, possibly months later, that we could then appeal.
But just possibly months later. I mean, there's a statement from the agency. Actually, before I ask that, let me ask this. Do you or do you not start that clock with your filing? Or does the clock not, or does the clock wait and start when they say,
The FCC shot clock starts when the applicant files its application for approval.
So that, in your view, the 90-day window, or in the other side's view, the 150-day window, that started running as soon as you filed your application?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your amended application.
Your Honor, I believe, is talking about the underlying zoning.
Don't you concede that the shot clock started when you filed an amended application in August?
Yes. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. I see my time is out, unless you have further questions.
No, you're on our
question. Okay, that's fine.
So that agency is talking about, with its expertise, this is what we think is a reasonable time period within for a state agency to act. And that clock started with the filing of your amended petition. What makes you think that because you couldn't do anything to provoke them to get something to you in writing as soon as you would like, that it's still not within the reasonable bounds of that state agency's authority to wait and issue its statement in writing when, as long as it's within the shot clock?
Well, Your Honor, there are two thoughts that I have on that. The first part is the requirement to issue a written decision is an independent part of Section 332.
That assumes the answer, doesn't it? I mean, that's part of what we're talking about here, is whether it's final because they said something at a meeting or it's final later when there's something in writing. Your answer assumes that it was final because they said something. That's the thing we're trying to wrestle with.
No, the point I was going to make, Your Honor, was that if we find that a written decision is the final action and can be the only final action that would trigger the ability to file a complaint, we could never file a complaint that says that they failed to issue a written decision as part of their denial. I view it as an independent requirement under Section 332. Subsection 3, little 3, says that the decision to deny must be in writing and supported by substantial evidence. If we say that it has that we can only file once there is a written decision, we could never claim that they've failed to issue a written decision.
Why would that be? You make it sound like that would be of null and no effect. Somehow it would be surplusage. Why can't that section actually cut exactly the other way and be a statement that not only is this is a command to the agency to do it, but it's a requirement for finality? Why can't it be both?
I suppose it could be, Your Honor. And let me point out that in their answer in this case, the city alleged that with its October 26th vote, which they called it the ZBA decision repeatedly, they said that they had acted within a reasonable time. That was in a paragraph, I believe it was 109 of their complaint, their answer.
Yeah. doesn't Roswell actually, I mean, indeed, doesn't the Chief Justice's dissent in Roswell say, well, sensible agencies now will wait and they won't have a final decision until they've got their written stuff teed up. So, in effect, it's almost like an encouragement from the Supreme Court, okay, you've seen what we said in Roswell, I guess it won't be final until you do something in writing. Isn't that the sort of the bottom line that the Chief Justice gives people from Roswell?
It's a conundrum this raises, certainly, Your Honor. I would point out again, we recognize that there's a dilemma here about a written decision. It would certainly be clear if there could be a written decision. We believe that in order to have a final act, there must be a written decision. That just as the court in Roswell said that the reasons must be contemporaneous with the written decision should be contemporaneous with the denial to prevent this kind of conundrum that we get caught up in about whether or not to file.
We're caught up in part in this conundrum because instead of filing a supplemental complaint or leave to file a supplemental complaint within 30 days of the written decision, you waited over a year.
Your Honor, I don't know that it was a year. I can't remember the dates off the top of my head. But that's perfectly acceptable under the cases. That's exactly what happened in the securities insurance case. The reality is, in this case, it's not as if there was a question about the existence of that decision. The parties mentioned it in a filing to the court just 3 days after it was issued, and the parties proceeded under
it. Nobody's suggesting that Wilmington was caught flat-footed, but that I think you're missing the import of Judge Van Aske's question, which is, we wouldn't be here at all if you filed it timely, but you didn't. So you represent a sophisticated party. They can afford to hire excellent lawyers like yourself. They know these cases. They litigate them all over the country. We've been talking about one of them at some length, Roswell. And why shouldn't you be held to know what your time frames are and live within them?
Because, Your Honor, two reasons. Number one, we believe that, as I said, that we had a final action. Number two, the parties notified the court of the existence of that written decision in that scheduling order, and the parties went forward to litigate it.
Your answer seems to me to be kind of avoiding and not answering the question. When you say we believed we had a final answer, you might have believed it, but you knew you had a final answer when you got something in writing. You pressed them for something in writing. You sued them. You said they'll only respond when you sue. Okay, so then maybe you're right about that, but then they gave you something in writing. Why didn't you just file something then?
Sure, Your Honor, and it certainly would have been easier if we had, but the courts have recognized that the rules of civil procedure want cases to be decided on the merits. As long as there was no surprise to the city, which obviously there could not have been in this case, the parties, it was the city's own written decision and the parties moved forward. The issue of when we perfected the formality of noting in our complaint the issuance of a written decision that everybody knew about, the rules of civil procedure say that should be fine, and let's get to the merits, which is what we are seeking to do in this, Your Honor.
That seems to assume that we're not talking about jurisdiction here. I mean, I know you say jurisdiction, a mere formality, a simple technicality, but jurisdiction's, we take that pretty seriously usually. If this was jurisdictional, then your assertion that the rules just allow us to walk past that without really concern seems to take the issue kind of lightly, doesn't it?
No, Your Honor, I don't think it does. The courts in Matthews versus Diaz, Wilson, Bates versus Westinghouse Electric have all noted that this supplemental complaint can cure even what might be a jurisdictional issue. Though in all those cases, it was an issue of, there was a premature filing when there was for something that was alleged to require, be a requirement for the court's jurisdiction. And those courts, including the Supreme Court and Diaz, said that that's the kind of remedy that Rule 15C is intended to allow, to lead to merits rather than technicalities.
Okay. If my colleagues want to tell me, just a historical question here to ask you, and that is, could you still, is there anything to prevent you meaning T-Mobile, from going to the city of Wilmington and filing exactly the same application today?
Today, I don't think so. There may be a limit. Many cities have a provision that says you can't file within. Many cities have a provision that say you can't refile the same application within a certain period of time. Sometimes it's a year. I don't remember off the top of my head.
I think Wilmington's got 6 months. I'm not sure of that.
Okay, but I can't remember.
We're well past that point. You could file the same thing today, and all your rights would be protected. Is that right?
We could refile. I believe so, Your Honor.
And I think that hasn't happened yet.
No, we have not, Your Honor.
Okay.
Judge Nygaard, any questions?
I have none. All my questions have been asked and answered. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Thank you. We'll have you back on the rebuttal.
May it please the court. My name is Joe Van Eaton. I'm representing the city of Wilmington in this matter. Let me start, if I could, by addressing the Riverkeepers case, because I think it goes to the question of when the decision became final, which is obviously critical to the determination, and then turn to what we think is critical, which was we think this is a jurisdictional provision, and even if it isn't, that the relation back doctrine doesn't work in this particular case to remedy the defect. Under Riverkeepers, the basic standard the court adopted with respect to was that a decision did not become final until it had substantive legal effect. That's the essence of the holding there. And in that case...
Then why don't you answer Mr. Thompson's assertion that there was substantive legal effect. They told us, denied, and that was that. There was no provision in the law for motion for reconsideration or anything like that. They were told, you're not getting this. And then, by their account, the city messes with the applicant by not giving them something in writing. And they do that regularly. But whether that's true or not, here they say, there was nothing for us to do.
There is no substantive legal effect until the order is entered. It can be changed up to that point. It's not final. It's just like some of the cases that held that even the cases that hold entry.
What should we make of the fact that the order itself says that now on the 26th day of October 2016, the board is of the unanimous opinion that the proposed use would not be in harmony and is denied in the present tense? Why don't we look at that as saying, well, that's the operative date?
Because the effective date of the certification, which is what's critical under the Delaware state law, is the date it was entered, which I believe was December 21st. So until that's entered, that's the operative date. All they're reciting is effectively, we took a vote on that date, but it doesn't take the action back to the 26th. The effective date is the date it's certified as a matter of state law. That's the way we apply it and the way it's applied under Delaware state law.
Why would we be paying attention to when you say as a matter of state law? You wanted to start with Riverkeeper. Riverkeeper repeatedly emphasizes that finality is a question of federal law.
Right.
The state chooses to call something final before federal law would call it final, or chooses to call something final after federal law would call it final. It doesn't matter.
Well, Riverkeeper obviously involved two different bodies, the EHB and the Department of Environmental Protection. Riverkeeper doesn't say, we look at whether the process, the Riverkeeper didn't sort of second guess state law as to how an authority made its decision effective.
No,
and that's really what they...
it doesn't second guess state law, but it does say we look at what is indeed final. We don't pay attention to what the states necessarily label it. So when you issue an order that says, as Judge Van Aske did, it's denied this day, why wouldn't we take that to be a final action as a matter of federal law, rather than saying, well, state law allows the agency to file it, imagine, up to 5 years later.
Now, what I'm saying is something different, which is the actual date that it had legal effect is not the date they took the action, it's the date that order was entered. So it's akin to saying...
I don't think we're saying something different. I think we're just must be not connecting. If they say it's denied this date, as a matter of federal law, what do you rely on to say, well, that's not really final because the state says it's not final until that piece of paper gets filed, and that could be months later? Why would, as a matter of federal law, we say, oh, that makes a lot of sense. It's not really final, even though they said final.
The question you asked in River Keeper is, when does it have legal effect, right? So if the city council was adopting an ordinance and on first reading voted unanimously to pass it, it's still not final until the third reading. And federal law would never come in and say, oh, it's final, even though it hasn't actually been adopted. It would look to the date that the action becomes effective. And that date is not the date that's entered, which is simply a minute entry, effectively. It's the date at the bottom of that same piece of paper, which said certified this date of blank. And you have to take those both into account, I think, to recognize that the action was taken on December 21st, not that the action became effective for purposes of having any legal effect on the 21st. Had they never entered the order, we couldn't have moved to enforce it. We couldn't have moved to... Nothing could have happened until that was entered, from our side or theirs.
If they'd approved it, could they have started building immediately?
If they'd approved it, they could have... I suppose it's hard to answer that question in the sense that they should not start building until the order is entered.
So,
yeah.
But if they'd gotten an approval, they could have gone out. They could have started... Well, they could have gone up on that roof and started constructing... Isn't that an odd world where a denial requires one thing but an approval?
It doesn't. Let me try to make my answer clear. Let's suppose we assume that there was a group of citizens who opposed the application and they started going out and building before the order was entered. The citizens could have stopped the construction until the order entered. If no one's opposing it and someone starts construction, no one notices it. I guess I'm trying to honestly answer your question. But technically, they should not begin construction if it's approved, and they aren't precluded from this. The city's not precluded from changing the decision. And by the way, they can ask for reconsideration or rehearing at any time. Nothing in this code precludes that. It is something that's actually permitted, I believe, under Delaware law.
The city of Wilmington knew that this was being contested from November 28th, whatever date the action was instituted. It was the action that was taken at the October 26th meeting. The written decision doesn't say a whole lot different than what was said by the members of the zoning board at the hearing itself. How are you prejudiced by the fact that they don't tee up the fact that there was a written decision? And even then, they did tee up the fact there was a written decision and a submission to the court December 27, 16. They sent a proposed scheduling order that referenced the written decision. How are you prejudiced here by the fact they didn't file a supplemental complaint until a year later?
So I guess the prejudice to us comes from the way the entire process is set up under 332C7, which in part goes to the question of is it a jurisdictional requirement. The idea of the act is obviously to provide some protections to wireless providers, but the title of Section 332C7 is the preservation of local authority. And local authority is disrupted when, as in this case, before the proceeding is actually finalized, we essentially have to come in and defend a case in federal court as well. That's why
we're defending the case in federal court. I mean, everybody knew what was going on. There wasn't some mystery. Everybody knew exactly what was going on.
I understand what I'm saying. The question was, how are we prejudiced? We're prejudiced because the way the act is set up, we get to complete our process before the action commences in federal court. And that is an important component of the way you protect local zoning authority. So we're if you imagine not just this case, but any case,
well,
where...
Now you're talking about the front end, right? You're mm-hmm. talking about, hey, they filed too soon, and that's a bad thing. Okay, that's a bad thing. Now we're talking, or at least I am, if Judge Van Ness, about the back end. you knew the whole time what they were contesting, and they filed a supplemental, leave to file a supplemental complaint. That was granted. So the question stands. How are you harmed? What's the prejudice to the city under those circumstances where, yeah, maybe they came out of the box too soon, but everybody knew it was at issue, and we're not even talking about the too soon piece anymore. Your argument is, well, you can't save your too soon because you filed too late, right? I mean, we wouldn't be having this discussion at all if they'd filed within 30 days of the what you assert is the final action, the filing of that in December, right?
That's correct.
Right.
If they
so
had filed in December.
The only issue is you filed too late. That's not right. So the question is, how are you prejudiced? Everybody knew what was at stake all along.
The difference between had they filed in 30 days, and we mentioned this in our brief, their contention, which they've litigated strongly, we've had to defend strongly, that we failed to issue a decision in writing, wouldn't have been available to them in any sensible way that they did.
Assume you win that. Assume you win that, all right? You win, there had to be a writing, okay? And they should have filed within 30 days of the writing, and they didn't. And now the question that we're trying to get you to answer is, how are you hurt? Assume for the sake of discussion, it's not jurisdictional. Assume we thought it's not jurisdictional.
Mm-hmm.
What's your harm? How are you hurt by what happened to you?
So I'm going to try. I'm thinking of your back end point. I'm obviously, I think, harmed by the fact that I have to expend resources to defend against a claim that's based on a prematurely filed complaint that they could have cured. And had they cured, we would have been in a position to deal with the fact that they filed that.
It's true in any relation back.
But
true in any relation back circumstance, right? Somebody could say, well, I wouldn't have had to deal with this. 15C, that's just so unfair. They didn't do stuff when they should have. But relation back says, yeah, maybe there's a little problem there. But you know what? We want to get to the merits, so we're getting to the merits.
I don't think that. I think that's different than the typical 15C case. Their claim is not that the writing itself, though they obviously want to raise a claim that the writing itself was defective. Their claim is that there was no writing at all. We've been defending against that claim. That claim would not have been available had they filed after December 21st in a timely way.
I think you're fighting a hypothetical now. I'm asking you to assume you win that, all right? But you win this, win on the point that there needed to be a writing, okay?
Right.
That they were wrong about they don't need a writing, et cetera, et cetera. And what we're talking about here is the merits of their petition or their application to be able to build this cell tower, which the city denied in part because of fears that radio waves would hurt people's brains, according to the record. Okay? And they say, that's just wrong. This is a matter of federal law. That can't be a reason. You're not, you know, that's the, I understand that's the merits stuff, or among the merits things they want to argue.
Yeah.
Since you knew all along that was the issue, and everybody's known all along that's the issue, what's the harm to the city in having to defend on the merits if this is not a jurisdictional point?
And I go back to, if we have to, you're saying it's irrelevant, and I guess where I would disagree with you is I think it's relevant that they pursued a claim that was based on the claim on a writing, a lack of a writing, and they could not have, had they filed in a timely way, that claim would never have arisen because the writing would have been plain. I understand your issue.
I don't understand what I'm getting at. I'm trying to get you just answer the question of prejudice.
Yeah.
If we're going to deal with the merits, I take it your answer is we're not prejudiced because all along we knew that was the merits issue. So if you deal with the merits issue, we have no argument. We have no argument that we're prejudiced on the merits because we did know all along. Is your repeated effort to say yeah, but it's about the writing. It's about the writing. An effort to avoid the merits issue.
Let me try to state it a different way. When the Act sets up a structure that's designed to protect our authority to make decisions, and that allows for some court review, and I think the Troop case out of the 11th Circuit sort of says that structure is very important, and we are prejudiced in our ability to go through that process if someone can file early and then file late and correct everything. It's so the fact that that disrupts the entire process and the decision-making aspect
the prejudice
of it.
Is, the prejudice is we don't like being taken out of our time box. But I'll repeat to you the question, isn't that always the issue with a non-jurisdictional point and the relation back provided for by 15C? Isn't there always some unfairness in that, but yet the rules say we'll live with that unfairness because we want to get to the merits? Isn't that the same thing in every relation back case?
I suppose you could say that there's certainly something, there's an element of that, but in this case, I think the difference is that you're trying to preserve that structure of decision making, which allows third parties like the public to participate. And when you disrupt that process, you impose cost, but you impose a disruption of the basic protections. And that's where the prejudice comes in. That's why you wouldn't allow it to come back, even if it's non-jurisdictional. You might say the parties could agree to extend it, but you can't come up with a situation where someone can file early. Just like you can't normally, that administrative cases, appeals, are deemed incurably deficient if they're filed before the order is finalized. The idea is to protect that administrative process.
Counsel Free was, as your opponents assert, that was a case where it clearly was a jurisdictional issue.
And I think in this, obviously, we feel in this case it's jurisdictional as well. While the Supreme Court sort of disavowed.
Deal with Sebelius then. Come right out of the box and talk to us about Sebelius. Because Sebelius says, in pretty strong language, hey, stop calling everything jurisdictional. Unless Congress says it's jurisdictional, you treat it as claims process. And that's and paraphrasing loosely, but that seems to be the message, isn't it?
Well, actually, I think what Sebelius says is, there's no magic words that are required. Congress doesn't have to say, this is jurisdictional. You look at the history, the context, and the text in deciding whether it's jurisdictional. And while it may not be just...
We inquire whether Congress has, quote, clearly stated that the rule is jurisdictional. And absent such a clear statement, we have cautioned courts should treat the restriction as non-jurisdictional in character. That's the language of the Supreme Court of the United States.
And isn't the next line or one or two lines down there that doesn't require magic words?
Yeah, it doesn't require magic words, but it requires a, quote, clear statement.
And you get the clear statement by looking, I believe the court said in this and in the Henderson case and in the more recent cases, that you look at history, context, and text in determining whether it's jurisdictional. So in this case, I think you look at the text, I think, while it may not be dispositive, it is certainly relevant that the cause of action arises in a section that says, except as provided in this paragraph, we're preserving local authority over zoning. So the federal intrusion is meant to be limited. It deals with the preemption issue, and that intrusion on constitutionally protected local rights is something to read narrowly.
How do you get from that to a clear statement of jurisdiction? Why isn't that just a statement about this is the way we want claims processing? This is the way it's supposed to work, as opposed to this is the way it's supposed to work, and it's jurisdictional, and if you go outside of this, you're done.
I think you look at the question, I think you then look at the, so you look at the creation, the fact that it's created within 332C7 itself, that it gives the cause of action that arises in it, and that the purpose is to preserve the local jurisdiction. And if the purpose is to preserve the local jurisdiction over zoning, then allowing an early entry, it goes back to my point, which is whether you view it as jurisdictional or as arising under an equitable principle, allowing someone to disrupt the process by filing early. And we're talking about not just this case, but anyone could come in and file early and then correct under 15D later as a strategic, and, you know, their complaint admits this was a strategic matter. It was a strategic choice for litigation purposes.
But they could have done that. They could have done that within 30 days of issuance of that written decision, and we wouldn't be here at all.
That would be,
so,
and all that
I don't
would
know, I really don't follow this disrupting the local autonomy.
Because if they had filed within 30 days, what we would be essentially saying is, we're just saying they filed a valid action against the city within the time the statute allows. That's why it would be permissible.
I have one question on
sure.
Local local rules, can T-Mobile come back in now and file another application?
Yes, they could. And presumably, they'll have the advantage of the orders. They could come in and propose the same thing. They could come in and provide the different evidence. They could come in and use a different technology to minimize.
What's at stake here? Why invest the money in the lawyers and the time? Since time, both parties are talking about, well, time is so important. Days matter to us. Why are we here, you know, way after the fact? If 6 months later they could have filed the same thing, what's really going on here?
That's a tough question for me to answer for the city.
Oh, I'll ask them too.
Because honestly, if I would have either refiled or come in and put in something called a distributed antenna system that uses the streets to provide the service. I mean, that was an option that was considered. I just don't, we don't understand it.
You really don't? You don't have any sense about what's motivating them? Because usually people don't spend this kind of money and time and effort unless there's something going on.
I honestly don't, because I the closest I can come to it is they don't want to give the Zoning Board of Appeals a chance to act on a new application.
Because?
I think they won't get a positive answer, but I don't know that that's true at all.
Is it because they're afraid they won't have some zoning board member stand up and say it's because of radio waves?
No one said that, I don't think, but you had citizens say that. There's no question citizens will come in and say that. The board's not going to act on that basis, and they didn't act on it. And our view is they didn't act on it in this time. But I think what they're concerned about is that there are alternatives that would not involve the placement of this facility at the location involved with what amounted to an additional structure. That's my take. But I don't know that that answers the question, because if their concern is providing service, we think there are alternatives to providing service. And it would certainly make the case clear if it was refiled and then appealed in a proper manner. I mean, that's one of the reasons why we think viewing this as jurisdictional is helpful to a clean decision and avoiding putting courts in a position of second-guessing what was done at the local level.
Ms. Nygaard? No? Okay.
I have none. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Banny. Mr. Thompson, your rebuttal. And you could start with the question that I asked Mr. Banny and Dan. Since you can, I heard you say you could do it, and he said you could do it. That is, just file a new application on behalf of T-Mobile. Why the time, money, effort, expenditure to litigate this case when you could add a fraction of the cost and much sooner have filed a new application and gotten an answer?
Oh, because two reasons, Your Honor. First of all, we believe that the original denial was incorrect on the merits in several respects, and why would they grant it the second time? They're just going to issue the same denial. What the council is suggesting is that we should file the same application, get the same denial, and then go through the same litigation a second time with all the same facts.
It wouldn't be the same litigation, right?
What's that?
It wouldn't be the same litigation.
Sure.
Because right now, no. The litigation we're fighting right now is whether you get to get to the merits at all. That's what this is all about. That's what this appeal is all about. It's not about the merits. It's about whether you get to the merits, right? And we wouldn't be having this fight if you just filed another application. So that's why I'm a little puzzled, and I don't want to take us too far off topic. You know, the inner workings of the T-Mobile strategic planning folks. I mean, I'm not asking you to reveal something you shouldn't. I'm just trying to figure out, as a practical matter, why we're fighting over a purely procedural issue. Unless it's because you got a record below that you think helps you on the merits that you don't think you can recreate the second time or something like that. I'm just a bit flummoxed.
Your Honor, I believe that the answer comes down to, we believe that the district court was wrong to, at that last minute, avoid the merits based on a technicality, and that, in fact, it had before it a record that had been developed.
You could have gotten to the merits way sooner than this if 6 months later, at the moment you could have filed, you refiled, the clock would have started, their shot clock would have been going. I mean,
you'd have gotten a merits decision before you're going to get a merits decision, clearly before you're going to get a merits decision, after we rule on a procedural matter, and then it goes back to a district court, and the district court, if you win, says, okay, got to go back to the city. So it's not making sense to me for you to say, oh, we just want a decision on the merits, because you'd have been at the merits a lot sooner than this.
Your Honor, I'm not sure that we would have. It took us a long time to get to the merits then, and we believe that under the court erred under the clear law in failing to rule that the supplemental complaint cured anything. Counsel's, first of all, just to address quickly the jurisdictional point, the Section 332, subsection 5, is very different from, for example, the 28 U.S.C. that grants jurisdiction to the courts of appeal for FCC appeals. So we think that under Sebelius and the other cases, there is no clear statement here, and there's no indication from the text. The other thing I wanted to point out is counsel kept arguing that their process, you know, that this was somehow interrupting their process. In their answer, they repeatedly said the ZBA's decision is supported by substantial evidence. The ZBA's decision, I'm quoting here, does not effectively prohibit. They knew exactly that they had acted. They knew that they could respond on the merits to our claims. They didn't say, we haven't acted, we don't know what to say to this yet. That's what they could have said if this was truly premature, but it wasn't. Everybody knew what was going on, and it was appropriately, the formality of the pleading was corrected in a timely fashion, and we believe that under the Ninth Circuit's decision, the Eighth Circuit's decision, even the Supreme Court's blessing of those cases, this is exactly the kind of case that Rule 15C was intended to reflect the remedial nature of the court, of the rules of civil procedure, to get to, so that the district court could have reached the merits that were before them at the time.
Okay. Thanks very much, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Appreciate the argument of counsel. We've got the matter under advisement. We'll call our next.